Hello, everybody, and welcome to Divine Manifesting. Hope everybody is doing well, and I'm really hoping you're taking just a moment in this beautiful fall day to enjoy and appreciate the beauty of the day. My friend and cohort in crime, Christy, is traveling today, but she does send everybody her well wishes, and she will be back next week. I am thrilled to tell you that we have a wonderful guest with us on the show today. Her name is Asha Praver, and she is a minister, lecturer, and she has been doing yoga philosophy for over 36 years, and she's just a wonderful, gifted, articulate speaker who has traveled quite a bit and given thousands of lectures, sermons, and classes throughout America, Europe, and Asia. She is one of the foremost teachers of the Ananda Fellowship, which is a growing international spiritual movement with communities and centers throughout the entire world. I don't know if anybody has seen her, but she's appeared on numerous radio programs and television. And I'm thrilled to tell you that she has a new book coming out called Swami Kriyananda As We Have Known Him. So we are just beyond blessed to have Asha with us today. Welcome, Asha.
Thank you, Rebecca. Very kind of you, and I'm delighted to be here.
Well, oh my gosh, no more delighted than I am to have you here with us. I anticipate an hour filled with wonders having you here. So thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to be with us. And I was wondering if you could just share with the listeners a little bit about yourself, Asha, and how you came to study and write about these great masters.
Well, like many people of my generation, I turned 60 this year. Oh. I think I've been a seeker since I was born. Mm-hmm. My earliest memories of childhood are just looking out at this world with a state of slight puzzlement as to what the deeper meaning behind what I saw was. And even as a child, I kept thinking that the adults around me had some understanding of what this secret was, but they were just holding back until I got old enough for them to share it.
Yeah.
And I was a little surprised as I did get into my early and late teens to begin to realize that most people just took life as they found it and were not asking the same questions that I was asking. I went on and started college at Stanford University, but I was very disappointed because even my professors at such a prestigious university were simply not asking the questions that I wanted answers to. And above all was a very, very simple one, which is, what is the key to happiness? It didn't seem enough to me merely to accomplish this or accomplish that. If the heart wasn't fulfilled, then what was the purpose of it?
Mm-hmm.
And I began to look into a different spiritual path. I was never a religious person as a child. I was raised Jewish, but not a practicing Jew. And I never even really thought of spirituality or God as the answer, but it was the late 60s and people were beginning to look toward the East, so I turned my attention that way and was very intrigued by what I found in terms of meditation and a more personally directed approach to spiritual life, less about religion and more about spirituality. But I was still in a state of confusion because I couldn't see how to take the idealistic things I was reading and turn it into an actual day-to-day way of life. I mean, here we are in America. We're not in the Himalayas. I'm not a Catholic. I wasn't going to go into a monastery. I just wanted to live my life, but I wanted it to be more uplifted and more meaningful. And right into that state of mind, Swami Kriyananda walked. Kriyananda is an American man. His name is also Donald Walters. At that time, he was about 42 years old, and I was 22. And he had, in 1948, become a disciple of an Indian guru named Paramhansa Yogananda. Many people know Yogananda because he wrote the book Autobiography of a Yogi,
mm-hmm.
which even after all these decades is still one of the most influential books around.
It really is. I was just I have his recent copy and was just reading that it is selected as one of the 100 best spiritual books of the century.
Well, that's not surprising. Even today, it'll still top bestseller lists in the nonfiction biographical category.
Right, right.
In any case, Yogananda was a very important figure, even, has been since. He came to America in 1920 and died in 1952.
Mm-hmm.
So he was off the planet before I became serious about my spiritual life. And I had seen his book, but I couldn't quite connect with it when I first read it. I'm talking the late 60s now. It was a little just too far out for me. But when Kriyananda came on the scene, and I actually saw him at Stanford University. He gave a lecture there. Someone invited him to lecture. And I was sitting in the audience, and he strided into the room. He had an Indian name. He was dressed in Indian clothes, but his whole demeanor was Western.
Mm-hmm.
He spoke very educated, articulate English, and his whole context of life was very Western. And yet, and I have to admit, it happened to me just in really literally in a matter of seconds, I could feel in his consciousness that he had accomplished what I desired to accomplish, which was to integrate the ideals of living according to truth and to honor and devotion to God. He'd integrated into his life. He'd made it into a way of life. And I felt in that 1 minute that he could teach me what I wanted to know.
Mm-hmm.
And I very soon after that, at that time, he was living in San Francisco. I was living just south of San Francisco. And he was starting a community, which he calls Ananda, up in the foothills of Nevada, the foothills of the Sierra Nevada. And he talked about, you know, the work he was doing. And the community also struck me as just a marvelous solution to the dilemma of seeking friends and finding meaningful work. And very shortly after that, that was 1969, and by that was the very end of 69, and by early 71, I had left everything behind, and I was living in this very, very simple, primitive is really the word, but very simple community that we were starting up in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada. Now it's a beautiful community with lovely homes and schools and a retreat. Then it was almost bare land.
Asha, where is that? You said the foothills of the Sierra. What town?
It's right near, right outside of Grass Valley, California.
Oh, my gosh. Ugh, just a stone throw away. That's so wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah, you kept saying that, and I'm like, where?
No, it's still, to this day, it's one of the most successful cooperative communities in the world.
Huh.
It's a model community that, since then, we've replicated that model.
Right.
We have 8 communities now.
Uh-huh.
But that's still the first. And,
wow. Okay. And can anybody come to visit or retreat there? Okay.
Okay. It's the retreat is called the Expanding Light.
Uh-huh.
Or you can simply look up Ananda, A-N-A-N-D-A.
Uh-huh.
And it'll take you into all the different options that you have.
Right. Right.
Anyway, almost as soon as I came to Ananda, I developed a close association with Swami Kriyananda. Just right away.
Uh-huh.
I soon became his secretary, his personal assistant. I worked with him every day, really for a decade. And very soon after I started working with him, I became conscious of the fact that my intuition was right, that he embodied and expressed the ideals of the spiritual path of Yogananda, of self-realization, of Kriya Yoga meditation, which are all just specific words for the God-centered approach to life that so many people seek. And I began to have with him and observe in his company many, many extraordinary events, some miraculous, but more than that, the extraordinary example of an individual whose consciousness was true and clear and whose devotion to serving others was refined and very unusual. And it crossed my mind very early that the experiences I was having were not for me alone, but that it was meant that I should share with others what I was experiencing. And I began to take notes right then. That was like in the early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And so for 30 years, I took notes of my experiences, and I took notes of the experiences of others, and then I talked to many people about their experiences with him. And finally, in the last year, the book that I had been writing was published, and it is a collection of first-person accounts. It's not a biography in the conventional sense of, you know, just the events of the life. It's seeing him through the eyes of those who have been impacted by his life. So it's a collection of stories, Swami Kriyananda, as we have known him.
Mm-hmm. Now, is he no longer in body?
No, he's still living. He's 81. In about 5 years ago, he lived in America until the late 90s. His primary home was in America at Ananda Village near Grass Valley. In the late 90s, he moved to Europe, and we have a community in Assisi, Italy. And he took up residence right in that community. And then in 2003, at the end of 2003, he moved to India to start in a community there. And he lives mostly in India now, although he travels back and forth to the West also.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like a fascinating book. Now where did Kriyananda, did he have a guru? Did he have a mentor? How did he, you know, become who he is?
Well, that's always a wonderful question, isn't it? The example of how do we become who we are. That's exactly the question I try to answer in this book, is how to become, not only to present the picture of Kriyananda, which is useful, but to present the picture of how one can become like such a person by specific example. And that's what the book is. It's example after example. But let me answer your question. And Kriyananda was 22, as it happened. He had reached the point in his own life where he had dropped out of college. He had a desire to be a writer, but then the ambition to be a writer waned because he felt he didn't have anything true to say. And he felt he had to develop himself to a greater level of wisdom before, as he put it, he didn't want to just flood the world with his ignorance. And he was thinking of going off somewhere to be a hermit and try to develop himself in some way. And in a very mysterious way, he had seen the book Autobiography of a Yogi, which had only been published 2 years earlier, because this is 1948. And then he thought of the book and then found himself literally mysteriously turned in the direction of the bookstore, and almost compelled by a power greater than himself to go to that bookstore and buy the book. And so he just took it off the shelf and went home immediately. He was living in New York City. He read the book cover to cover, as he put it, scarcely eating or sleeping. And as soon as he finished it, the next day, he got on the bus in New York City and went all the way across the country to Los Angeles, California, because Yogananda was still alive at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And he found Yogananda, and the first words he said to him were, "I want to be your disciple."
Hmm.
Kriyananda himself says, "I never thought I would ever speak those words to any living person." He said, "I was very strong in myself. I wanted to find my own truth." But he also had the humility and the intuition to realize, when presented with spiritual greatness on the level of Paramhansa Yogananda, that the greatest act of wisdom was to put oneself in his hands to learn from him.
Mm-hmm. To surrender.
To surrender in the way that a person surrenders to a true master,
mm-hmm.
which is no shred of personal effort is taken away from you.
Mm-hmm.
But what you are, it's like if you wanted to climb Mount Everest, and you've never been on the mountain before, and an experienced guide offers to take you.
Exactly.
Then you say, I will walk behind you, because you know the path.
Yes. It seems like there's such importance. It's a journey like any other journey and like no other journey, but it's a journey. And I think, you know, as you're talking about having a mentor, a teacher, a guide, there's such importance to that. There's almost, it's necessity to have somebody who has been there, who knows the way, who can guide you. And as you're talking, Asha, I can feel that sense within to almost become, it's such a paradox because you become so empowered, but you also become like a child putting all of yourself into the hands of that great teacher, trusting so fully, you know, that they literally have your life in their hands, but yet it can be such an empowering. It's our greatest act. It's our greatest thought. So it's sort of that little paradox, at least I'm feeling within, is it's almost that breath out, that relief to find that mentor or guide who you can say, I want to be your disciple. I want you to guide me. So, you know, for all of us Westerners, you know, how we're not really, I think, you know, many of us have that deep religious tradition. And what do you see as the difference between having a spiritual mentor and a spiritual guide versus how many people traditionally hold their spirituality through traditional religious means? Is there a difference, Asha?
Well, all true religions, and you know that's most of the major religions, are true in their inception. Whether they're true in their present expression or not,
mm-hmm.
it varies.
Mm-hmm.
But if one believes that spiritual development is possible, then the obvious extension of that thought is that some people are going to be more spiritually developed than others.
Mm-hmm.
And the key to becoming a disciple is to have an attitude of receptivity and humility and the willingness to learn, balanced by really a tremendous inner personal strength that allows one to discriminate between those who merely claim to be able to help
mm-hmm.
you and those who actually can.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's no true teacher will impose himself upon you or try to break down your resistance. It has to be a consciously offered willingness to accept wisdom where you perceive it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a question of one's own intuition.
Right. I love how you're saying it is that balance between surrendering and, you know, I heard it as, forgive me if I didn't grasp this, but I heard it as taking responsibility for your communication with your source, with your divine, with, you know, it's really taking that, taking the responsibility to cultivate it, protect it, and own it as your own. I feel so often people that I work with or people that I talk to relegate that space, that
right.
connection to others to then shape and tell them who that divine is or how to communicate, how, you know, and I always feel like, you know, that's yours to protect and to own as your own and to find your own language and to, you know, really not give that away, not give that power away to somebody else to tell you how to think, be, you know, feel or act in the presence of. So you know, I at least for myself, I'm feeling, as you said, it's that balance between seeking outside of yourself for that great teacher and taking responsibility for what you know to be true. So I'm wondering if a lot of us have been programmed out of that. To, you know, we forget that we come in with our answers and we sort of have that internal GPS system that knows how to find what is real and true, and some of us just get real programmed out of that, and then we start taking in anything and making it be our truth. So you're saying it's through that deep wisdom and that deep intuition that we will know who the teacher is that's meant to take us to the next step?
I think all of that is true. I think we've also had programmed out of us respect for wisdom when we meet it. We've become quite cynical.
Mm.
And cynical for good reason, because there was a certain naivete also is part of the American character. And so it's a fine line we're walking. Let me just give you an example, you know, and this is what What I've tried to do in this book is tell stories of practical teaching that are relevant even if you weren't there.
Mm-hmm.
And here's an example. I was having a very difficult personal crisis in my life, and I had a very sincere desire to do the right thing, but I was in a state of complete confusion as to what the right thing was. And I had the opportunity to speak to Swami Kriyananda about the dilemma I was facing. And he was sitting in a chair, and as it happened, I was sitting on the floor in front of him, and there was this hassock between us. And I was describing my difficulty, and all of a sudden, I was very overcome with the emotion of the whole situation. This happened in my 20s. And I put my head down on the hassock, and I began to weep. I could be quite dramatic in those days. And I said between my sobs, "Oh, it's so hard to know what God wants." And then Swamiji just very simply said, "No, it's not hard to know." And then he just didn't really say anything else. He just wasn't forthcoming with any more advice, and he's often very forthcoming. So I sort of just had to walk out of the house, go back up to where I lived, a short distance away, and I started meditating on his comment, and I thought, well, it's easy for him to know.
Mm-hmm.
But then I realized that that's not what he said. He didn't say, "It's easy for me to know." He said, "It's not hard to know." Mm-hmm. No, it's not hard. So I started asking myself, well, why is it hard for me to know? And because I try to cultivate self-honesty, the thought immediately came, because you don't want to know.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have desires that you are protecting. And if you really let yourself understand what your higher self is calling you to do, you're going to have to face some disappointments and some sorrowing you'd rather avoid.
Mm-hmm.
And so I changed the question in my mind from "What does God want?" to "What am I afraid of?"
Mm-hmm.
And then later I spoke to Swamiji and I described the whole sequence. And I said to him, whenever I have trouble knowing what God wants of me, it's always because I'm afraid of something, isn't it? He said, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm willing to face my fear, then the truth is obvious, isn't it? And he said, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And ever since then, whenever I or anyone who comes to me for help, speaks in those same terms, I change the discussion. What are you afraid of? And always, and it's not always an immediate answer, and the immediate answer is not always the deepest answer, but whenever I trace that thread of fear, at the end of it, I always find simple clarity of God's will.
Mm-hmm. It feels like we spend so many years of our life creating our identities,
mm-hmm.
creating our, somebody-ness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I think a lot of, as you were posing these questions, what are you afraid, it's almost like, well, boy, I'm going to have to bust down one of those identities I spent so forever. My somebody-ness is going to crumble. Do you understand that?
Exactly.
But when you can get really clear, as you just illuminated, it was so clear, and I'm so eager to get my hands on this book because I can feel, the hundreds of stories in there that we can all learn through a story.
Yes.
I love the stories.
Yes.
It's like we learn through people's stories, through people, showing us an example of their life. And I really just got such a deep sense of that through your experience. And it really just brought it forward. It's like, oh, yes, it's not hard to know God, but it's hard to set down. So it's not hard to know what God wants or what is best for us. It's just hard for us to put those parts of ourselves that we've created so much time building. But then I'm going to have to let go of my somebody-ness, and that's just what will happen then. Who will I be? And so herein lies the dilemma. But to have such a great teacher who gently but lovingly points that direction out, shows you with great clarity, that's just such an amazing gift. So your book is filled with all of these stories that others and yourself have had,
right?
Revelations and
yes,
yeah.
That's exactly. It's nothing but stories from start to finish. So it's
mm-hmm.
extremely readable. But there's stories like the one I just told and
mm-hmm.
others similar to it, in which And you also see the sort of lighthearted humor in it, which a true spiritual teacher functions.
Yes.
Let me tell you another story. There's a man who's actually, he and his wife are foremost leaders in our community now. And many years ago, in about 1977 or 74 it was, when they were going to get married. Let me back up a little. There was, you know, the thing about Swami Kriyananda is that he's extremely accessible. He's always been a very natural person, and we've all been friends together, and oftentimes just one of the ways our community would function is at the end of the day, some of us would come to Swami's house, and we'd have tea together, and there was a good-natured rivalry that would always go on about whether or not it was better to have tea with milk and cream and coffee with milk and cream, or whether to have it black. And Swami and I happened to be on the side of really favoring putting milk in our tea and cream in our coffee, and we used to always spin these long theories about how spiritually advanced people would naturally do it this way. And Jyotish, who was also a very dear friend, of course, always asserted that anyone of true spiritual discrimination would understand that you didn't want to pollute the tea, and on we'd go. Well, anyway, Jyotish is about to get married to this lovely woman named Devi. It has been, and we all knew then, it was an ideal match. And Swami was going to perform the wedding, and everyone was very happy. And we'd had a meeting in the community, in Swami's living room, and most of the people had left. And Jyotish and I and a few others were sitting there. And all of a sudden, Swamiji Kriyananda has lapsed into a very thoughtful silence, and he's just staring at the floor. And we knew him well, and we could see that he was contemplating something, but he was a little reluctant to speak. And then he looked at Jyotish, and he said very seriously, "I really don't see how this marriage can work out." And, you know, Jyotish just goes completely pale, and we're all just shocked. He said, "Because you'll never be able to turn to your wife and say, 'You're the cream in my coffee.'" And then he sang the whole song, you know, from whatever it is from the 30s. "You're the cream in my coffee. You're the salt in my stew. You are my indispensable. I'd be lost without you." Uh-huh. And he sang it, and he has a very beautiful voice. And he sang it with full gusto. We were laughing so hard, I really thought we would never recover.
Uh-huh.
But it was just so natural and just so full of the joy of life.
Yeah,
and
playful. And
just
loving.
Playful. And
yeah. You know, there's somebody that I have loved for, a couple decades, and he reminds me of Kriyananda as you're telling his stories, and that's Ram Dass, who is a Westerner who's been to India, and I can listen to him forever because of that quality in himself where he's so self-deprecating, and here is this beautiful, beautiful man who has achieved so much in his life and so selfless and so absolutely sacred and divine, and yet he's so self-deprecating, and you just howl at his, you know, spiritual faux pas and where he, you know, he's so honest about his struggle that it makes it almost, for the Western mind or for anybody's mind, to, you know, it's accessible. If he can do it, if he struggles the way I struggle, you know, he did not just tell us he did that, did he? Then I can do it too. You know, so there's that human side and that light side that you so beautifully exemplified that I think truly is the mark of a great teacher, because they're not so lofty. They are, but they're not presenting themselves that way. They're showing us that be light with yourself, be, you know, be gentle. And I don't know, I love that. I love that quality that you're describing. Mm-hmm. So are there other marks of a great teacher, Asha? Is there something that we look for when we're calling for our guide or we're searching or reaching out for our teacher?
Well, I think we've touched on part of it. The other side of it is what's so extraordinary I've seen in Swami and other great souls that I've known, but none as well as he, that I've known as well as he, is that their consciousness encompasses the reality that the average person lives in, and yet at the same time goes to a level beyond what we can imagine. but always with a sense of humility and never with a sense of, I am something special, but this is just the way God chooses to work through me.
Exactly.
Swami Kriyananda has remarkable characteristics in his ability to transcend the limitations of that are normally imposed on people's bodies. For example, he had arthritis in his hips very badly for some 20 years. During the 20 years that he was building Ananda, we were building it together, but he was, of course, leading the charge, so to speak. By the time he finally had his hips replaced, the physician who did the surgery said he honestly did not know how Swami was able to walk because the hips were among the worst deterioration he'd ever seen. And when I asked Swami about it, I said, how could you stand it? He said, Asha, it was just one of many obstacles that had to be faced and overcome. He said, I never thought of it personally. He said, it was just something that was happening. We had financial problems, we had legal problems, we had personnel problems, and there was also the pain in my body. But I was doing the work for God, and it just had to be done. And when you think of just the kind of courage and self-transcendence that is required to just do what has to be done, that kind of perseverance. But let me just say one other part of it. In the presence of a true master, it's not merely that you think, oh, isn't he wonderful? What happens to oneself is that you have this feeling that I can do this.
Yes.
And that comes to a very large extent by the thought that teacher is projecting toward you. For example, this guest came to our retreat, and he was new. He'd never been at Ananda before, and he was meeting Swami Kriyananda for the first time. And he said to Kriyananda with great interest, he said, I feel more love from you than I feel from my own family. He said, I have just met you. How is that possible?
Mm-hmm.
And Swami answered, he said, I don't know you. You're right. I don't know you in the way your family does with all the details of your personality. He said, but when I look at you, I see the presence of God whom I already love. And so I'm simply loving you as an expression of the infinite to whom I have given my heart long ago.
And that's the person you want to be in the presence of. I'm over here crying.
Oh.
That is the person you want to be in the presence of, who can reflect back to you your purity that you have forgotten.
Exactly.
It gives you
confidence. And one woman wrote to Swamiji, she said, I never doubt that God loves me, because in all the years that I have known you, you have always been my supportive and loving friend. And through knowing you, I understand what unconditional love is.
Mm-hmm.
And the wonderful thing you see about an individual like Swami Kriyananda, of course, this is my relationship, so this is what I'm speaking of, but he illustrates the principle. And I use him to illustrate the principle because that was what was given to me. Is the fact that that consciousness is not limited to time and place.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've endeavored to do, and I am thankful to say that many people say I have succeeded in doing, is that when you read this book, you're in his company.
Mm-hmm.
And all of these incidences bring you into the company of his consciousness. And he's written dozens of books of his own in music. And I mean, there's many ways to access his consciousness directly also. But there's no, Yogananda passed away, you know, more than half a century ago, and yet you pick up Autobiography of a Yogi and you're right there. In his company.
Right. Yes. Now, it brings us to this point. You know, as you were saying that, I was thinking that pure reflection of the divine within each of us, that is not just something we access from Yogananda or Kriyananda. Do you believe, I feel this very as a truth within myself, that quality, that ability is within each of us to offer to one another, that as a mother to a child, you know, when we're in the best place we can be, we look at them purely. We're not looking at what they've done or what they've accomplished or how they failed or, you know, it's like to look at another human being and love them simply because they are a spark of the divine, because they are God, you know. And so I'm just thinking, he as our teacher, but he's also such a beautiful example of what we can do and how we can be that for one another. Do you know what I'm saying?
Oh, exactly. That's the whole point. Do you know that when Paramahansa Yogananda came to America, one of the things that he spoke of all the time was starting spiritual cooperative communities so that people of like-minded spirit could live together and practice with one another in a supportive environment, exactly what you're describing.
Mm-hmm.
And the key, I believe, is true to seeing God in one another is to see God in oneself, to be, once we're attuned to the spirit within, then we see the spirit everywhere.
Yes.
The Ananda communities, of which now I said that we have eight, have been like a living laboratory for how to live with God realization as the goal of life and experiencing and sharing the infinite with one another, just as you describe.
Mm-hmm.
And it's truly transformative. And the spirit of Ananda has been set by Swami. People are more important than things.
Mm-hmm.
It's always about helping and nurturing one another. I know a woman once, from the book is this story, a woman once wrote to Swamiji that she felt completely inadequate to perform the job that she'd been asked to do. And Swami wrote back to her and he said, I didn't ask you to take this job because I thought you could do good for others, although I believe you can. He said, I asked you to do this because I know it will be good for you to apply yourself in this particular way. And then he said further, I never ask anyone to do a job unless it's spiritually right for them. And then he went further to say, if there's a project that needs to be done, even if it's important, but there's nobody for whom it would be spiritually beneficial to do that job, he said, then I'll just let the project wait.
Mm-hmm.
And if no one ever comes, we'll never do the project.
Mm-hmm.
He said, otherwise it would be using people.
Right.
It wouldn't be thinking of their best welfare.
Mm.
And it just becomes a daily practice. What Swamiji said in another talk he gave recently, he said, most people try to solve situations. He said, I'm always trying to solve, insofar as I'm solving, the question of how to help people.
Mm-hmm.
He said, if in all situations we think, not how can I move this situation forward, but how can I help this person expand their own understanding, he said, in the end, everything will work out much better.
Right. You know, that's it. That's it, is if we just refocus and shift from all the outer stuff to the inner with one another and that spiritual journey, then the teacher, that's what the teacher offers to us, is, you know, you are so important. The greater self within, I know Christy and I are, starting this Thursday, our, you know, Power of Self-Love, a six-week workshop. And we're thrilled about it because it is, again, that space of coming in and cultivating and reprogramming and rewiring all those places within where we just don't think we're good enough, where we've been lied to, where we've been lying to ourselves.
Right.
And I think the great teacher can come in and look at you with all your foibles and faux pas, and oh my God, I'm a wreck. And they look right through all of that.
Right.
None of that's important. None of that means anything. And they see directly where you are absolutely perfect. And it's like I feel, you know, when we can start to grab just those little sparks of that within ourselves, that I'm okay. I am good because I am God, and then we then can offer that to others. So it's sort of that, which do we do first? But, you know, I think when the teacher shows up, they begin to reflect so beautifully and so non-judgmentally, you know, just the purity of ourselves. And as we can grasp that and fully almost enter into that, then we get to offer that to all others. We're less judgmental. We're less you know, we don't see them for what they've accomplished or their successes or their licenses or all the letters after that. We see them purely for just that loving heart and their intention and all of that. So, yeah, I can really see what he means by being in a community like that, because it's, I would think it just facilitates it.
It
facilitates it. Are there other things, you know, as we're all, I know, all the listeners on this show, they're just, they're wonderful, and they hear week after week, Christy and I just ramble on and on about divine manifesting. You know, but are there steps to transformation? Are there things that the great teachers tell us we should be doing, or we hint, not the no shoulds, but that we could be doing to accelerate our spiritual growth? Are there, you know, one or two that have been pointed out by Kriyananda?
Oh, yes, certainly. There's a whole, the science of self-transformation. When Yogananda came to America, he called it the science of religion. Yoga has now come to mean yoga postures, hatha
exactly,
yoga.
Exactly.
But yoga actually means union, and
exactly,
it's the integration on all levels.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very scientific method, beginning with right behavior, right attitude, right action.
Uh-huh.
And the basic principle is simply this, that the ideal principle of life is to do those things which expand your awareness, your joy, and your compassion for others.
Uh-huh.
And to make your choices in life in terms of how they expand your awareness and soften your heart toward embracing a greater reality. That means that sometimes one goes along with what other people want, and sometimes you stand against what other people want, because it's a question of what direction leads to greater awareness in yourself. Some very willful people do better to cooperate. Those who have tended to let themselves be overpowered by others need to stand up for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I think that developing a personal relationship with God within, however you define that, even if you just simply define that as with your own higher potential, is the first step to realize that, Kriyananda puts this in a very simple and a beautiful way. He says we never become less than the infinite, but we mistakenly identify with qualities in ourselves that are less than infinite.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that we have to accomplish anything. We just have to cease identifying with
mm-hmm.
them. So the first step is to begin to identify with even the possibility of a reality greater than the one we know.
Mm-hmm.
And by choosing love, by choosing kindness. But one also has to develop a deeper state of inner awareness. And this is where the practice of meditation, of course, is tremendously helpful, especially if meditation is done as a relationship to a higher consciousness within,
mm-hmm.
and not merely as a self-soothing technique, but one in which we actually lift our awareness to a higher level of reality than
cultivate
the one we know.
Cultivate that higher communion.
Okay.
Yes, yes. I know, I think the key word is awareness.
Awareness.
Becoming aware of, you know, what facilitates that space. As we begin to cultivate it, it's like, what makes it easier to be there?
Right.
And on, you know, conversely, what takes me away?
Right.
It may
exactly.
take me away for months. It may take me away for weeks.
Right.
Or even just moments. What takes me away? Is it my diet? Is it... You know, and I know a lot of us are fascinated with all those foods that make it very difficult to be in those higher realms, like sugars and caffeines and, fat, and, you know, you get them all in one.
Mm-hmm.
Get a chocolate donut and, ooh, that was good. I got it all in one,
mm-hmm.
one shot. There's a lot of foods, meats, and, you know, that really can take us away from those higher realms. So there's diet, there's, like you were saying, even actions, just our habits. And really, I think, you know, the first step is just becoming aware of, you know, when am I there? When is it easy to be there in those more, you know, blissful, joyful, just being in the flow of it all? And when do I feel like I'm just in resistance? You know, that, oh, trying to make something happen and it's not. You know, it's just that awareness of just sitting back and watching. What was I doing before? What was I doing when it was working? What was I doing when it's not? And beginning to cultivate more of those practices in our life, the habits. I'm a huge believer in watching our thoughts. And, you know, what am I saying to myself that, you know, is preventing me from feeling so connected and expansive and spacious? And what am I, you know, what am I saying to myself that is just, wants me to pull the covers over my head and go back to sleep? So it's all of these habits that, you know, I think we're all trying, we're all seeking, we're all looking for that deeper wisdom and meaning in life to, you know, what takes us back home, what takes us to that place of serenity. And so I think there's probably an infinite amount of things that we can do, and the teachers are here to show us the way, show us the way made simpler than struggling on our own. Now, let me ask you, Asha, how can somebody, if the listeners, I'm going to assume everybody's going to want, including myself, want a copy of your book, Swami Kriyananda as We Have Known Him, how do they, is it in stores? Do they go to your website? How can we get a copy?
Well, all of the above. You can order it directly. We have a website, www.doorofmyheart.com. Doorofmyheart.com will take you right to an order page for this book. You can also go to Amazon. You can go to Borders. You can go to Barnes & Noble. It's very widely distributed right now. So you can get it either by walking into a store or going on the Internet. Doorofmyheart.com will get it for you.
Okay, wonderful.
You know, one other thing, if I may say, if a person is first starting out and wanting to transform their consciousness, something that occurred to me is one should watch what external influences you're taking in, because we're always being influenced, and we may not realize the extent to which we're taking in influences that confuse or darken our awareness, or to put it conversely, bring bright, uplifting things into your life. Especially, I would speak of music. Find not music that's merely emotionally touching, but music that's genuinely uplifting. Kriyananda has written hundreds of pieces of music, and we have many, many albums that if you go to thedoorofmyheart.com, you're on the Crystal Clarity Publishers website, and you can go from there to other aspects of what Kriyananda has to offer. But music that really calms and uplifts your heart. Look at the environment in which you live, I mean your own home. What are the colors that you're using? What are the pictures that you have on the wall? I think we also have to realize that it's very hard to uplift yourself just by your own efforts. But if you bring into your environment a higher vibration, be it holy images that inspire you with higher consciousness, or the right kind of books that you can read, or the right kind of music, or you know, the spoken word by people whose consciousness inspires you, it's a little bit like singing in a choir and trying to learn the alto part. And if the alto part is being sung all around you, you find it easier to sing the melody too. But if you're trying to sing that alto part and everybody around you is singing a completely different song, it's much harder to find that note.
Right.
So you want to make sure that the note you're trying to sing is around you.
Yeah. It's a twofold process of really making a commitment to release those things that are getting in the way. Because I don't care how desirous you are, if you continue to have those obstacles coming in, you're just going to wear down, you know? So I think it's a twofold process of release. Become aware of the things, whether it's your diet, whether it's the people in your life, that negative person, or like you said, you know, the clutter in your household. Make a commitment to little by little start releasing them. Get them out of the way, and then begin to focus your attention on what are you bringing in. You know, I always like to say, if you can do one thing a day, just in the beginning, one thing that attunes your mind to that space you're trying to cultivate. Do it, you know, for 5 minutes. Or, like you said, it's so easy to listen to music And it just, music is, I agree with you, Asha, that takes no effort at all, but it really does attune your entire body, your energy, to, you know, that sacred sound. You know, you don't have to do much work. It'll just take you there. And so just even just, you know, in the beginning, doing one thing a day and you know, getting into the habit of, you know, focusing on that one thing and then letting it grow where that one thing becomes several. But I know in my practice, it's always been sort of that combination of what am I letting go of and what am I bringing
what
in?
What am I bringing in? Exactly.
What am I letting go of and what am I bringing in? And I think, you know, I want to throw out there, too, I think for most of us, we're so inundated with that consumer-driven mentality of have more, buy more, get more, and we just get so glutted. I think for me, one of the greatest things I did was begin to release that mentality and not buy into it and not feel like I had to have a house full of stuff. Just the releasing and living very simply has freed me to go deeper into my practices. Because there was a time where it's like I can't do everything. I just felt like I couldn't do more. And I thought that's because I'm holding on to so much stuff. And as I just started releasing, and that's an easy thing to do, just release the physical stuff. It's almost like it brings all this room in your life to bring in more. So, you know, if the goal is to move to that next space, I think you got to travel lightly.
You know, I've always appreciated from Swamiji what I've really learned from him is to be realistic and that there's, in his leadership of us, I recall a woman once was facing a very difficult test, and he gave her strong advice, which she simply wasn't able to follow. And she finally just truthfully, because it's very important to be sincere, if you want someone to guide you, you have to be honest with them. So she sincerely said to him, "Sir, I just can't do what you asked of me." And without missing a beat, he said, "Well, so much for theory. Let's deal with reality." And then he said, "Okay, so if that's out, then what can you do?" And what she ended up doing was following the exact opposite course than he'd recommended, but she did it with conscious awareness. And he said later, he said, if I had demanded of her a discipline that she couldn't meet, it would have just given her the sense of herself as a failure. Far better, he said, to support her in what she needed to do anyway, having her know that I was always her friend, and then let her do it with honest awareness and just see what happened from it.
Right.
And I've felt over the years that his genius as a leader has been there's always a positive step that you can take. And it's so important for people, whatever it is, just take whatever positive step you can take. I sometimes joke with people, if you're going to eat, if you know you're going to eat the whole box of chocolates, then take five of them and put them down the garbage disposal before
you
start.
That's it. Because I feel like we expect, we have this picture that, well, if I haven't gotten started in 5 years, because if I get started, I'm going to have to do, you know, chanting for 3 hours.
Right,
and
exactly.
And it's like, who told you that?
Yeah, who told you that?
Just start by cleaning up the front room closet.
just read a good book and enjoy
Take
it.
Take five chocolates out of the box. You're good. That was the thing you did today. Exactly. Read a good book.
Yeah.
And a great place. You know, and I think it's the same thing. It's like, oh, I didn't even start the book because I knew I wouldn't finish it. Who said you had to finish it? Read,
right.
Do the first chapter. You know,
right.
Find a little at a time. Do what, just one thing a day.
Well, it
begins to get our little toes on our path, and it's like, you know, and it's such, for me, it feels like such a childlike space to start. You know, it's, there's no seriousness here. Just one small thing, and do it with joy, though.
And it gives us an experience then of what it is that we're seeking. I mean,
yeah.
That's what a spiritual teacher does for us, either in person or by his vibration. He gives us an experience of what we're seeking, and then the other half of it, which you speak truly of, it's not so difficult to release because you're going somewhere. If you know where you're going, then you don't cling so tightly to what you have.
Right, right.
And that's the whole key, and that's
yeah.
The friendship, the kindness, the vibration of a master coming into our lives gives us an actual experience of where we're going.
Well, and I think I'm so grateful that we've had today, Asha, and I'll tell you why. Because You know, something you said during this hour is that when you read a book like Yogananda's or you know, your new book, Swami Kriyananda, the spirit, the essence of that great teacher, it's not just for the people who sat before him physically.
Exactly.
He comes through. I know I've had that with many books where the teacher, it feels like I open my eyes startled because I really expect to see them sitting in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
Their presence feels like, I can't believe it, they're here with me right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel that in your book. And so I think anybody can go out today and take the great wisdom, because that essence comes through and the teacher will sit in front of you and guide you if you sit quietly and listen through the words, through the stories. It's almost like you have your own personal mentor, your own personal guide with you in that moment. And I think that is something each of us is very capable of doing, is in our own way. We may not make it up to Grass Valley.
Mm-hmm.
We may not make it in the next weekend to our local ashram, but we can pick up that book and feel the essence of the teacher come through, and we can turn to them and say, oh, what now? What do you want me to do now? Where should I go now?
And in that joyful upliftment, then one goes out and passes it on to others, and the circle just expands and expands.
Exactly.
Right.
Well, I can't believe it, Asha. I cannot believe it, but we are at the end of our time, and I wanted, you know, I can't say enough. I will definitely be online the minute we hang up, picking up this book, ordering this book, and I just wanted you to maybe say one more time where they can go.
Okay. You can go online, www.doorofmyheart.com, doorofmyheart.com.
Okay. Or Borders, Barnes & Noble.
Or Borders or Amazon,
oh,
Barnes
beautiful.
And Noble. Yeah.
Oh, that sounds so great. Well,
Swami Kriyananda, as we have known him.
Yeah. And also go maybe get some music. Order yourself.
Once you're on Door of My Heart, there's a vast number of resources from Kriyananda and others that could be of great help to all of you.
Oh, how exciting. How wonderful. Well, you know, it's available. It's there for us, and we don't have to do anything but take one small step and just say yes to today, yes to this gift. So I thank you so much for sharing your hour with us. It's been so uplifting, and I can't wait to pick up your book, Asha, and hopefully you will join us another time. And
I would be delighted, Rebecca.
Would you?
It's been a joy to talk to you.
Oh, Asha, that would be so great. Well, thank you so very much for your time and your wisdom, and thank you for giving us this wonderful gift of a book. I'm sure so many of us will benefit from it and from the great teachings that Kriyananda offers to us. So, Asha, thank you, and to everybody on the program today, I know you feel as blessed as I do. My heart is just so expanded right now. So have a wonderful day. Thank you to everybody, and a special thank you to you, Asha.
Oh, God bless you, Rebecca. Thank you for your good work, too.
Okay. Bye-bye.